Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
As you know, and you'll have read from the description, I'm going to be telling you a little bit about these resources called A Test of Faith. I'm going to do that through explaining some of the material covered by them, the sort of concepts of science and faith, put it a little bit in context of why these were produced, cover some of the main material that you've probably got some grasp of if you're here and listening to this. I know some of you have quite a lot of grasp of it. And then I'll go through some of the details of the resources, what's available, how they can be used. But as I say, please do stop me at any point with questions. I'm very happy to do that. So I shall start by introducing myself a bit. You've read my bio, but I always feel like it's better to do this with pictures. So my first pictures are by way of explaining the first thing you need to know about me, which is that I'm a Christian. I grew up in a Christian family, and I was encouraged from a really early age to explore my faith, to really think about it, to think about what it was, what it meant to me, to question, was this really what I wanted my life to be about, what I wanted to base my decisions on, and the way that I formed my life and my ideas about the world. So it was very much not a case of kind of, oh, you know, I believe this because my parents do or anything else. It's been very personal for as long as I can remember. And has always been completely central and the most foundational and fundamental thing in my life. You'll have read some stuff that I'm involved with in the bio, so I won't bore you with that, but I spend quite a lot of my time singing and clearly highlighting the Bible a lot. So the second thing you need to know about me, really, is my interest in science. And this is by way of explaining that I've always been quite interested in science, or as I tend to introduce myself in schools in the UK, this is my way of owning up that I'm a bit of a geek. I don't know if the word geek translates across every language, but this is a picture of me when I was about 8 or 9 years old. I was on holiday in France, and this is me with a praying mantis. And this goes down particularly well when I'm talking with young people, because you then get to describe and sometimes even do an impression of a praying mantis and quite why they're so exciting. So when you go from starting off talking about some bug that's making people a little bit squeamish to explaining how they sit pretending to be a leaf or something camouflaged beautifully against a bush, and then they grab an unsuspecting moth out of midair and rip its head off and suck its guts out, then you suddenly get people engaged and quite interested. So this is my admission. I've always been interested in science. As I got a little bit older, that turned into studying science. I went to the University of Cambridge to study natural sciences, majoring in evolutionary biology, behavioral biology, geology, and the history and philosophy of science. So I covered a sort of a broad breadth of things, which involved quite a lot of getting stuck in mud and stuck in trees and various other things. There was a bit of a theme. But for me, science and exploring the world has always been very much about exploring a world that I believe that God created. It's been about exploring nature and trying to discover how it works, and doing that with a mindset that included God as creator, a mindset that told me this is a world that God created and I can find out more about it. And I've always really enjoyed that. But as I did this, as I grew up sort of keeping these two things hand in hand, my Christianity and my love of science, I encountered a lot of questions. Lots and lots of people would come up and say, well, how can you be a scientist and a Christian? How can you study evolution and be a Christian? How does that work? And so as these questions started coming, I sort of thought about it and I thought, oh, well, how does that work? You know, maybe science and religion are opposed. Maybe there is some kind of conflict. So the more I started to read about it and think about it and discuss it, I kind of came through a way of thinking about it and came out very much where I'd started, which was a sense of, I don't think there is a conflict. I think science and religion go very much hand in hand. I think science is a way of exploring the world that God's created. And so the more I thought about it and the more I continued answering these questions from people, I thought, well, maybe I should do this for a living. So I now do. I work with a group called the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion. We're based in Cambridge in the UK, and we're an academic research institute. And we exist to perform research into how science and religion fit together and interrelate, and also to communicate that to people through the medium of courses, conferences, lectures and seminars, through schools work and youth outreach, which is what I'm particularly involved with, and also through the production of resources. So a lot of that is online, and then there's some particular resources that I'm talking about today, which is called Test of Faith, which was produced to help people to think through these questions of science and faith for themselves, to explore them and to apply that to running courses and their own small group sessions, whether that be with adults or young people. I'll explain more about the different type of resources involved in there later. But these are some of the big ideas involved with the Test of Faith resources. As I mentioned a little bit already, they exist to help put science into the context of faith. It's not about giving all the answers. They don't just present a set of answers to people and say, well, you know, go away, believe that, that's it, sorted now. They're about equipping informed exploration and discussion. They're about helping people to really think through these questions, aimed for people either in the church or outside of the church who haven't necessarily studied science or theology in any great detail, but are aware of these questions, aware of the media presence and the cultural presence that tells us that science and faith might not fit together, that maybe there's something going on between them. And this is aimed to try and help people think through that in an informed way. So do that. There's some several points that sort of come through the Test of Faith materials in a big way, and one of them is this, that God is glorified through scientific study of his creation. This serves both to say that we don't need to be afraid of science, and also to say, well, actually, the more that we study science, the more that we look into it, we discover something about this God that can be a part of our worldview, that shows us something more of who he is and the kind of creator that he is. Another major theme is this, that science allows us to explore, understand, wonder at, and better steward God's creation. This idea that being involved in science is a really positive thing, particularly for those who believe that God is a creator, that he created a world worth exploring, and it helps us to discover more of his world, to celebrate it, and to perform what he asks us to, is to look after it. And the third great theme here is that science should be embraced and celebrated by Christians, for some of the reasons I've already mentioned, and a few more that we'll come on to later. So these are some of the big ideas covered in Test of Faith, and as you can see at the bottom here, it does that by focusing on a number of different areas of science. It doesn't just focus on the big obvious questions to do with the Big Bang and creation or evolution, but takes it further than that to look at things like stewardship of the environment, ethics, neuroscience, lots of different areas. A couple of commendations, just to tell you that I'm not the only person who thinks these resources are a good idea, before we get much further, from Professor Carson here, saying, these resources featuring prominent scientists who are Christians deserve wide circulation. Here are scientists trying to think clearly, humbly, and wisely about the Christian faith. Any thoughtful Christian will delight in the way the grace of God reaches men and women in the scientific disciplines, as in all other domains. Another here from Professor Packer, saying the level of human insight matching scientific expertise in these resources is high. The personal stories in the book have left me feeling that these scientists are folk with whom, as a mere theologian, I would love to spend some time. I hope other readers will enjoy this set of testimonies as much as I have done. And a third one here from Reverend David Robertson, saying, I think these resources are excellent, and I intend to use them regularly in my own church and apologetic work. And I think you can't really say better than that. I think it was a glowing commendation for which we thanked him greatly. So we're going to get into a little bit of the material covered by Science and Faith, by the Test of Faith here. And I'm going to do that by way of a short introductory clip from the DVD. You probably know already that Test of Faith is centered around a set of films. I'll tell you more about them later, but there'll be some clips from that throughout the presentation to give you a bit of a taste of what Test of Faith is and how it works.
At the deepest level, the debate between science and religion is really a debate about how do I obtain reliable knowledge about the world? How do I know that something is true? How do I know something is false? How do I know something is reliable? Something is unreliable? That's a terribly important question.
The world divides into two classes. The people who think that why is there something rather than nothing is a very deep question. Those who see the point of the question. I think why there's something rather than nothing is an important question. And God provides to me the most satisfying answer.
John Polkinghorne, yeah.
We all try to make sense of our world. But how do we know what we know?
I think a lot of people don't live their lives very thoughtfully at all. And everyone's a philosopher in one way or the other. They have their own little philosophy, their own theology, or what's important, what's not. A lot of people, they pick up ideas from school, from their parents, from TV, from what they read in a magazine, and they kind of have this patchwork idea of what's true, what's right, wrong, what's important, what's not important. And they live these kind of unexamined lives. And so what the science religion debate helps people do is think, hey, why do I do what I do? Why do I believe in God? Why do I not believe in God? Is it because I was brought up that way? Or is it because I've really thought about these issues carefully, objectively?
Behind the science-religion debate lie challenging questions. What is the nature of our world? How did life come into being? And, most importantly, is the universe pointless, or is there some purpose to it?
So there you go, a bit of an introduction to Test of Faith, to the type of material that it is, and some of the questions that are covered within it. So as we start our introduction to science and faith and some of the topics covered within these resources, I always have to start with this question. I think, has science disproved God? And the reason that I start with this question is because I think this is an idea that is quite pervasive in our culture. It's kind of foundational to a lot of the ideas that we have surrounding the conflict between science and faith, or the apparent conflict between science and faith. Oftentimes, I myself have done this, you may have done the same. If you ask somebody just off the cuff and say, well, you know, what do you think about God? What do you think about faith? And the number of times they come back and say, oh, well, science has done away with all of that, hasn't it? And this is an idea that is pervasive throughout our culture, throughout the media, for any number of reasons. I'm sure we could all mention various publications that might have had something to do with this particular idea getting into the public consciousness. But this is something I like to approach right from the start, and I do this with people of all ages. And I give two answers. I say, well, yes and no. And this sometimes shocks a little, because after my initial introduction, people always expect me to go, no, of course science hasn't disproved God, and here are all the reasons why. And I am going to do that. But first off, I want to pick up on my reason for saying yes to this. And that's because I think it depends on what we mean by God. To explain that a little bit, this is my idea why I think actually, in some senses, I would say that science has disproved some ideas of God. And that has to do with this idea that now we have science, we don't need gods anymore, which is the one that I mentioned that is in lots of people's minds. And that refers to this idea of God, the kind of idea of God that is often referred to in these discussions, the gods of ancient mythology, gods who existed as an explanation for something in nature that people didn't understand, like lightning or volcanoes or something. Something would happen in the natural world and people would point to it and go, ah, well, that must mean the god of the mountain is angry with us, or this must be to do with the god of the ocean. And in this case, I think actually science has done quite a lot to disprove this idea of God, to remove it from the public consciousness, to say maybe that idea of God isn't really something that's all that valid to base your life around. And the reason that it's done that is because the job of science is to explore the natural world, to try to explain it, to try to figure out how it works, to look at things like smoke coming out of a mountain and say, well, where does that come from? How does it work? Science is explaining things like plate tectonics. It tells us about the world in a way that makes us think maybe where these gods stood in as explanations for those natural functions, there isn't quite so much of a place for them anymore. So in that case, I actually think, well, yeah, I think I would say that science has disproved those kind of gods. And when people say, well, science has killed off God, in this context, I would probably agree with them. There's a man here that you probably all recognize. This is Richard Dawkins. And I have a quote here from him that I use at this point, and you'll see why. This quote says, "We're all atheists with respect to almost all of the gods in history. Some of us just go one god further." And this is a very important point in my yes and no answer here. I think I agree with him. A lot of us are atheists with respect to almost all of the gods in history. But some of them go one god further. And the reason that I don't go one god further is because of the nature and the character of that one god. So who is this god that we're talking about? Who is this one god that's a little bit different? And this is the god that we're talking about, which in this context you could equally talk about as the god of the Abrahamic faiths. We could talk about this as the god of Christianity, of Islam, of Judaism. To talk about a god, and it's a very different picture of God from the gods of the ancient world. This isn't a god who, the picture that we get from our scriptures and our writings tells us he's an explanation for some natural function that we don't understand any other way. This is a god who claims to be the author of all of creation. the ultimate author, the ultimate creator, bigger than and outside of and greater than and more powerful than anything else we could possibly discover in the natural world. Within the understanding of Christianity, this is a God who's even greater than that, in that he's not just some awesome creator, but he's a personal God who wants to have a personal relationship with us and came down to earth to do that. We know the gospel. We know how this relates. I don't need to tell that to you. If I do, I'll just get very excited and end up preaching a gospel message instead of talking about this. But this is a very, very different idea of God. There's a lot of verses I could have picked out to sum this up, but one of them is this, in Revelation 4, saying, "Worthy are you, our Lord and our God, to receive glory and honor and power. For you created all things, and because of your will, they existed and were created." So this is saying not only that God is the creator, but that because of that, he's worthy of all honor and glory and praise. Yes?
A very quick question. Would you bring up this scripture even when you're talking to school audiences, atheist audiences at this point?
It would depend very much on the audience. If I've been invited in a context to, say, a Christian union or something by teachers, and depending on the context I've given already, I sometimes bring in scripture verses, at which point I would say, you know that I'm a Christian, I'm talking from a Christian perspective, this is a verse from the Christian teaching which underlines my point here. With a Christian audience, it's obviously slightly different. So I'm currently rejoicing in my freedom to be able to expound scripture verses as much as possible. I have another quote here, which I would bring up at this point, from Augustine in the 5th century, saying, "Nature is what God does." And the point that he's making here is that there aren't two separate realms of the natural and then the supernatural. We don't have a realm of nature which is apart from God, and then an understanding of God which is separate to that. He's saying nature is what God does. It's the outworking of the supernatural in the natural. The reason that we have a natural is because of God. So now that we've got this idea that maybe science and faith have got something to do with each other, I've given you some impression that I think they work quite well together. But practically, how does that work? How do we go about thinking about how science and faith might be compatible? And to do this, I'm going to ask a very deep and theological question. Why is the kettle boiling? This is an example I'm sure many of you have come across. It's a favourite of John Polkinghorne's and many other people's. And this I ask in schools all the time, and invariably get exactly the same response to it, which I will probably get in any room, including here. So why is the kettle boiling? If I walked in here and there was a kettle boiling away in the middle of the room, and I turned to you and said, "Why is this kettle boiling?" What could you tell me? This is audience participation time.
I forgot to switch off the stove.
Excellent, yep, fair enough. In which case it might boil dry, which would just be sad. So why is the kettle boiling? Come on, easy answers here. Imagine yourselves to be a high school. So we have these two answers here. We've got an answer from science with our glorious chemists and physics explanation saying the water is boiling because there's an application of heat, and we've got an exchange going on in the energy, and we can explore that. We can explore the scientific answer. Alternatively, you could come in and say, "Well, the kettle's boiling because I want a cup of tea." And this is an example of a situation in which we're perfectly happy to take two different types of explanation, take them alongside with each other, and build them into a picture to give us a bigger and a better picture of what's going on. They're both answering this question, and they're answering it in slightly different ways. The science is explaining the mechanism of what's going on. It's exploring mechanism. It's exploring kind of how the kettle is boiling. Whereas wanting a cup of tea is exploring the why. It's kind of bringing a meaning and a purpose to the situation. Now, being British, I should obviously expound the fact that tea brings purpose and meaning to every situation. Unfortunately, I don't actually like tea, so I'm not really a very good British person in that respect. But in this situation, the tea is bringing meaning and purpose to the boiling of the kettle. It's giving us a context in which the mechanism makes even more sense. Now, it seems very odd to explore the possibility that we might say that these two ideas are in conflict. You're very, very unlikely to turn around and say to me, no, I don't believe you that you want a cup of tea. The only answer I will expect, take for this question, is that the heat is boiling the water. And you're very unlikely to turn around and say, no, I don't believe you about all the molecules and all of that that you're talking about. The only reason I will accept for the kettle boiling is wanting a cup of tea. Now, I'm labouring this point slightly, but that's because it's quite important to recognise that in this situation, we very happily take a mechanism and a meaning, hold them together, to give us a bigger and a better picture of what's going on with this kettle boiling than we would have if we just had one explanation or the other. And that type of relationship between mechanism and meaning is the same type of relationship that I and lots of other people think applies to the relationship between science and religion in when we look at the questions of life, the universe, and everything. So where we're exploring questions of the universe, where we're exploring our worldview and how we figure out what's going on around us, we have lots and lots of things like science that help us to understand the mechanism. We can look at the world around us and explore it with science and find out loads about it, find out a lot about the mechanism of the world around us. But there are other questions that have to do with meaning and purpose that aren't answerable by science. But they are answerable from other sources, and this is where religion or faith often comes into it. For a lot of people here, they would bring in questions of meaning and purpose, and they would relate those to an understanding of faith, an understanding of religion. For me, Christianity has always provided the best answers to those questions of meaning and purpose. And I don't find them to be in conflict with the questions of science, with those understanding of mechanism. In fact, just as with the kettle boiling, I think that here, where we have the mechanism and the meaning working together, it gives us a bigger and a better picture of what's really going on than we would have if we just had one or the other on its own. A quote here from John Polkinghorne, who we've heard from a little bit already, who is in fact the Reverend Dr. Sir John Polkinghorne, just to give him a few of his titles, saying the same thing. Science and faith are not in conflict. They are both concerned with the search for truth, but for different aspects of truth which fit together. Science tells us how the world works, but religion tells us that there is a meaning and purpose, something being fulfilled in the unfolding of the history of the world. So we need both of these perspectives if we are to truly understand the remarkable world in which we live. So having established that we've got science and faith, science and religion approaching slightly different aspects of truth, different aspects of the same questions and building in to a bigger picture, I'd like at this point to look at a little bit of the history of science and religion. This is something that people don't very often get a chance to look at in schools, or in fact in the world in general if they haven't looked into it specifically. And I'm sure that many of you are familiar with this, and it will be a very brief history of science and religion. So we're starting with Greek natural philosophy. This is way back in the day with people like Plato and Aristotle and Socrates, before any established ideas of Christianity like we know today, and before any established ideas of science. And these ancient Greeks and many others in other civilizations around the world were trying to figure out how the world worked. They were trying to figure out what everything around them was about and drawing together ideas to do that. And natural philosophy, as it was known at the time, was not science as we would call it now. It was a mixture of astronomy and physics and chemistry and philosophy, all kind of mixed in together. Probably not recognizable to many of us from the subjects that we study today, but it was a way of trying to figure out the world. And they made some massive advances. They came up with some amazing ideas and built into a lot of the foundations of the way that we learn about the world today. But one of the things that they didn't have that I'm going to focus on a little is any tradition of experiment. Now, the tradition of experiment is very important in science today in the way that we do it, going out and testing the world. And that didn't exist in this way of thinking. For Aristotle particularly, he had this idea that the world he saw around him was a reflection of a perfect nature of things elsewhere. So that was also reflected in our minds. And if we wanted to know something, if we wanted to figure out how something worked, if we sat and thought about it long and hard enough, we would eventually come to the conclusion that would tell us the truth about the world. So as thinking came over to Europe eventually through the Islamic world and a lot of other places, I told you this was going to be a very brief history, science and religion, we have natural philosophy entering Europe. And natural philosophy at this stage is being studied in universities, which have been set up primarily to study theology. Set up by people who wanted to study a world that God created, wanted to explore more about God, God as creator, and God as the basis for their lives. There'll be a lot of recognizable names coming up in just a minute, but at this point, just to recognize that that natural theology was at this point coming very much into contact with Christian theology. It was being studied and explored by people in monasteries and universities set up to God's glory, including people like Kepler, who described doing science, doing the natural sciences as they were becoming known, as thinking God's thoughts after him. So God as creator was very much an idea at the basis of the study of the natural sciences. All of these names you'll recognize, the faces you'll know, all of these people, examples of those who were fundamental to the beginnings of science as we know it today. Absolutely fundamental to it, their ideas, the way that they worked, and all of them people who held the Bible to be very important. For many of them, they had what they would call a personal Christian faith, and that was reflected in the way that they did their science, even the way they wrote about it. So Kepler, as an example, would write about his science, he would discover things, and he would write prayers and psalms in the margins of his work. He would write everything in, as all the best people. So I think it's wonderful to think back and look back at the beginnings of what we know of science, and to see, well, for these people, science and faith were very much interlinked. They were doing science as a way of exploring a world that they believed God had created. And one of the ways that had a serious impact on science and the way that we think about it was in the introduction of this experimental idea, the importance of experiment. The idea of going out and testing the world to discover it, which came about because they believed in a world made by a God who gave structure and law and purpose to things. And so they would go beyond that and look for that structure, law and purpose in the natural world too. This is reflected in the introduction to Newton's Principia Mathematica, written by Roger Coates, who was a 17th century mathematician, who said this: "Without doubt, this world could arise from nothing but the perfectly free will of God. These laws of nature, therefore, we must not seek from uncertain conjectures, but must learn them from observations and experiments." So this quote beautifully summing up this idea that God made this world, so we need to go out and explore it, because there'll be laws, there'll be patterns we can look for. And so that tradition of experiment, which is so much a part of the science we do today, along with many, many other areas, was very directly influenced by an idea of Christian theology, an idea of God intertwined with science. But it wasn't just the case back then. Often at this point, people will say, oh, but everybody was a Christian back then, and we all know better now. We know far more about science, and we don't need to bother with that anymore. Surely, nobody today really takes seriously this idea of God and science together. At which point, I disagree with them, and give them a few examples of the many, many, many people working at very high levels in science in all kinds of different areas who hold faith in God, not only to be kind of compatible with science, but to be totally fundamental to their study of science. That for them, their science is a worship to God. But so all of these people, and you start to tell people about Francis Collins, who works in genetics and is the head of the Human Genome Project, Jennifer Wiseman, who's the project manager of the Hubble Telescope at NASA, who is not only a woman in science, but also a Christian woman in science, and all of these people involved in many different areas of science, all seeing it fundamentally as their worship to a God who they believe in wholeheartedly. A quote here from Francis Collins saying, "I think there's a common assumption that you cannot both be a rigorous show-me-the-data scientist and a person who believes in a personal God. I would like to say that from my perspective, that assumption is incorrect, that in fact these two areas are entirely compatible. I have no reason to see a discordance between what I know as a scientist who spends all day studying the genome of humans and what I believe as somebody who pays a lot of attention to what the Bible has taught me about God and about Jesus Christ. Those are entirely compatible views." So just summing up everything that I've been saying so far about it, the fact that it's not only possible to kind of hold science and faith together, but for many, many people, for a long time throughout history and today, it's been really important to them that actually science is a way of exploring the worlds that they believe God made. So now we're going to have a little look at this word scientism, this concept that perhaps science is all we need. Because although there are clearly some people around who think that science and faith work together, a lot of the world around us seems to say, well, maybe science is enough on its own. Maybe we don't need to bother with those questions of meaning and purpose that we thought of earlier. Maybe science is enough by itself. So first off, we're going to have a look at this as a view from philosophy, and you're going to have another break from me speaking here for a moment. We're going to hear from Alistair McGrath in another clip from the Test of Faith series.
For me, natural sciences are one of the most robust and exciting areas of human intellectual endeavor. In other words, the science are able to investigate things without rigor, which you don't often find elsewhere in human intellectual activity. But every method needs to be calibrated. In other words, we need to work out under what conditions is it reliable and when does it begin to lead us astray. In other words, are there limits to the sciences? And I think there are, and certainly I've been very influenced by Peter Medawar, a very famous Oxford immunologist who won a Nobel Prize for Medicine back in 1980. In a book called The Limits of Science, Medawar talks about science being extremely good at analyzing our material world and uncovering its complex relationships. But, he says, when it comes to questions of meaning, why we're here, or value, what's good, science doesn't really help us at all. Now, it seems to me that is not a controversial statement. Science has its own domain within which it is supreme, but there are other areas where it can't help us very much. Is there a God? Well, science actually can't answer that question. But I want to make this point. That does not mean that that question cannot be answered. It simply means science can't. So we look somewhere else for those answers.
So there we have a clip from Alistair McGrath explaining and beginning to explore this idea that science is very good at exploring the type of questions that it's set up to explore, a particular set of questions about the mechanism of the universe, as we looked at earlier. But that actually there are lots of other different types of questioning and different types of knowledge that not only are valid to look at, but actually that we look at every day, that we bring into our lives and the way that we think about things every day, whether we recognise it or not. This is a bit of a visual to try to explore and explain that a bit. So we have our scientific questioning up here, but we find that not only is it slightly distinct, but also interlinked with these lots of other types of knowledge, like moral and ethical questioning, aesthetic questioning, historical, experiential, and religious. And we often find that these types of questioning and types of knowledge are linked into each other as soon as we start to explore any one of them. So if in science, for example, we may get to a point where we explore atoms and the structure of atoms, and then we think, oh, well, maybe we can try and pull these atoms apart. How's that going to work for us? And then suddenly we discover we have this enormous release of energy. And what are we going to do with that? You know, we can use that for scientific advance, but also we can create enormous weapons which are going to cause a massive amount of destruction. We can use things for good purposes. We can use things for purposes that we don't know if they're going to be good or not. So we have to bring in this moral and ethical questioning up here. And as soon as we start asking moral and ethical questions about what we should do with cloning, how far we should take our genetic technologies, we find that actually there are religious questions that come into this as well. That these different types of knowledge interlink with each other. So it's important to recognise that there are distinct and different types of questioning about the world, but also that they interlink with each other in a way that's very important to recognise and to be able to think about. We have another quote here from Dr. Jennifer Wiseman, who I mentioned earlier, saying a very similar thing to what Alistair mentioned Peter Medawar saying. And she says here, "Science is limited to characterising the regular workings of the natural world, and it does so very well. But I believe that there are profound truths that science is just not equipped to address, such as questions of purpose, God, meaning, and how we should live our lives." And one of the reasons that I put in this quote, as well as having the quote from Peter Medawar, is that I often use both of those quotes together, because Peter Medawar, as well as being a very clever scientist who won a Nobel Prize, was an atheist who expanded the limits of science, who would say, science has limits, it's very good at what it does, but there are questions outside of that. So we have the same quote, the same ideas about science having limits from an atheist and from a Christian here. Which I think is quite a useful thing to recognise, to say science is really very good at doing what it does, and we can all agree on that. We can do that science. But we have to recognise there are other types of questioning that come into this, and our worldviews will inform how we think about those. So now we have a very, very brief look at a view from Christianity, saying, well, you know, is science all we need? And I'm sure that the answers to this are very clear to you, which is why there's only really one slide here, with a few Bible verses talking about creation, talking about the joy of God's creation, the beauty of God's creation, saying things like, well, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of his hands. And one of the things I want to draw out from this is this idea, as said in Psalm 111 here, great are the works of the Lord, studied by all who delight in them. Full of splendor and majesty is his work, and his righteousness endures forever. And what this brings out for us is a rejoicing, a celebration in the works of God, in his creation, in how beautiful they are, and how exciting it is to study them. But it moves directly on to saying his righteousness endures forever, talking about God in a way that doesn't necessarily just relate to science. And I like to sum this up by saying Christian faith celebrates the natural world. This is in scare quotes here, because the word natural has some very different meanings to different people. All I mean by this is the world we explore around us, the world made of material, if you like, of matter. And it celebrates that world as God's creation, but it places it within the context of our supernatural God. It says this is a world that God has created. It's a beautiful world, and it's a part of the way that we find out about God. It's a part of what God has done. It's a part of his nature. He's a creator. This is what he's created. We can explore it, but it doesn't tell us everything about him, and it's not everything there is to know. So Christianity, as you obviously know, would say, yes, science is exciting, but there's much more to it than that. There's much more to finding out about the world than we can just through science. So to get on to my final point in my coverage of science and faith in this little run-through, to say, well, Christians should embrace science. And I've got another video clip here for you to explain this a little bit. This is a video clip created for a church service within the Test of Faith materials. It's Psalm 8 being read. I'm sure you'll recognize it. So we'll go through this and then a couple of points after that.
Our Lord and ruler, your name is wonderful everywhere on earth. You let your glory be seen in the heavens above. With praises from children and from tiny infants, you built a fortress. It makes your enemies silent, and all who turn against you are left speechless. I often think of the heavens your hands have made, and of the moon and stars you put in place. Then I ask, why do you care about us humans? Why do you concern for us weaklings? You made us a little lower than yourself, and you have crowned us with glory and honor. You let us rule everything your hands have made, and you put all of it under our power. The sheep and the cattle and every wild animal, the birds in the sky and the fish in the sea, and all ocean creatures. Our Lord and ruler, your name is wonderful everywhere on earth.
So there we have one of the many, many parts of the Bible that we could have picked out that rejoices in God's creation. Explores it, starts to look at it and wonder, and it leads to thinking more about God, to say this is the beauty of creation and this is how it fits within an understanding of God that we would recognize as part of Christianity. So from that kind of passage, I'm going to cover just a couple of points as to why I think Christians should embrace science. And the first of these is that science helps us to understand God's relationship with his creation. We've seen a couple of these verses already today in this presentation, saying, well, the heavens declare the glory of God. They're showing God rejoicing in his creation. You know, God saw everything that he'd made, and behold, it was very good. We have this picture throughout the scriptures of God really enjoying his creation, not only enjoying creating it, but loving it, taking joy in it. So a Christian perspective would say, well, if God's enjoying and rejoicing in this creation, then why shouldn't we? I have a quote here from Robert Boyle, who's kind of giving this message back in the time where he was studying and writing, and saying, when with bold telescopes I survey the old and newly discovered stars and planets that adorn the upper region of the world, and when with excellent microscopes I discern in otherwise invisible objects the inimitable subtlety of nature's curious workmanship, and when I study the book of nature, I find myself oftentimes reduced to exclaim with the psalmist, how manifold are thy works, O Lord, in wisdom hast thou made them all. So in this quote, he's going into quite a lot of detail about the science that he's doing. Not only the stuff that he's seeing, but the things that he's discovering it with, the microscopes and the telescopes, the instruments that allow us to explore this world, and turning that directly into worship of God. And so this is one of my first reasons to say, well, science helps us to understand that God loves his creation. And the more that we discover about it, the more we see about why he loves it, the more we discover the joy there is to be had in exploring God's creation. Which brings us to this second point, that science helps us to explore God's creation. I have a quote here from Albert Einstein, which is very famous, saying, "The most incomprehensible thing about the world is that it is comprehensible." He couldn't quite get his head around the fact that we could understand the world. And this is here to point out that as Christians who believe that God made us, we believe that God has made a natural world and us with minds that can understand it. A natural world which does function according to laws and principles and which we can explain, we can begin to understand, we can explore it and make sense of it. And there's something in that, I think. All of us have this drive, this curiosity to find out how things work. From the youngest child who keeps asking, but why? How? Why? And as we get a bit older, we sometimes phrase those questions with a few more words in them. But essentially, we have this inbuilt curiosity to find out something about this world. And to my mind, it makes a lot of sense to think that that's a part of the way that God made us. Another quote here from Kepler. I love this quote because here he says, "I had the intention of becoming a theologian, but now I see how God is, by my endeavors, also glorified in astronomy, for the heavens declare the glory of God." So here he's saying, my science is my way of glorifying God, my way of worshipping God. This is a way in which I can bring glory to God and discover more about him and his creation. A final quote here from Augustine saying, "Whatever pleases you in a work of art that brings to your mind the artist who wrought it. Much more when you survey the universe does the consideration of it evoke praise for its maker." And there he's summing up this idea that when we look at the world, when we explore the universe around us, the more that we discover about it, the more we discover how amazing its creator is. So we shouldn't have any fear that as we look into science, as we look into the natural world, we might discover things that turn us away from an idea of God. But if we believe in a God who created this natural world, created it beautiful and incredible, then we can expect that the more we look into it, the more we find out about it, the more amazed and astounded we will be by the glory and the creative power of God who is behind it. My third point here relates to something I mentioned earlier, that science helps us to steward God's creation. This is one of the main responsibilities that we're given as people on this earth. God asks us to look after the world, to take care of it, not only the people on it, but also the rest of the world around us. I have a quote here from Steph Bryant, who's a UK conservation biologist, saying, "The Bible tells us that God gives man the responsibility to rule over creation. If, as Psalm 24 states, the earth is the Lord's, surely we should try to make our rule reflect God's great and awesome love for all of creation." This is a very simple point. I'm not going to labour this for a long time. But we have the idea that all of the things that are involved in caring about the people and the world around us, conservation, healthcare, agriculture, disaster prevention, ethical discussions, all of these things that come up when we try and figure out how we relate to the world, they can be informed by science, and they should be informed by science. And if we want to be representing God's love for creation in a responsible way, we need to do that in a way that is informed by what we discover about the world around us. If we want to be looking after the world, stewarding it well, looking after conservation and each other well, then doing that in a way that's informed by scientific discovery, by what we can discover about the world around us, and to have a voice in those discussions of what we do with that, that is informed by God's love, is a very, very important thing. So a final point here is that science helps us to reach God's people. And this is a very, very important part of why we're here as well. We're here to look after the world. We're supposed to look after the world while we're here. But fundamentally, I'm sure we'd all agree that our main purpose is to reach people, to tell them about God, to help to show people who God is and that they can come back to a relationship with him through a relationship with Jesus. So as we consider this, we think, well, how does science play a part in this? Is it the case that science is going to give us the one piece of evidence, the one piece of proof that will show people exactly about Jesus and about relationship with God? Is science the proof for God? And at this point, I bring up a couple of quotes to say, I don't think that's quite the case. This is a quote from Ruth Bansiewicz, who's the editor of Test of Faith, who some of you know. This is the only time she's quoted in here. She was very careful to make sure I didn't talk about her too much. But she says here, "Creation is not God, so it doesn't fully reveal his character or his purposes. For that, we need Jesus." I think we could all agree with that. Creation is important, as I said earlier, but it's not everything. Jesus is the only way to God. Another answer here from Alistair McGrath saying a similar thing. If the heavens really are telling the glory of God, this implies that something of God can be known through them. But it does not automatically follow from this that human beings, situated as we are within nature, are capable of perceiving the divine through the natural order. And what he's saying here is that science isn't enough on its own. It's not enough just to look at the science. It's not going to give us ultimate proof for God. And there are lots and lots of different opinions and ideas that we could talk about around that for a long time. But essentially, I think most of us would agree with this idea that really the only way to salvation is Jesus. Science is not going to provide that. But it is very important to be involved in science and to embrace science for a couple of reasons on top of these. Firstly, science is a respected and important part of society, and Christians should be involved with it. If only for that reason. A lot of the people around us respect science. They know a lot about it. They know how it works. It's very, very respected and important. And for Christians to be involved with that sends a message that we care about the world. We care about people. We care about knowledge. And we can explore this. We can explain this. There will be a lot of people, particularly in the academic scientific world, who we can reach because we're involved with science. Secondly to that, questions about science and faith, as I've said already, are a very important part of people's questioning. For a lot of people, that's where they stop with their questions about faith, until somebody tries to explain to them that science and faith actually can work together. So although this isn't a primary issue, perhaps, it's not as important as Jesus, actually questions of science and faith can form a stumbling block or a stepping stone for people on their journey to faith. It can be something that can be very important in people's discussion and thinking in terms of getting to a place where they can think about Jesus. To underline that a little bit, the culture this is in, the way that this can be important, and also throw in another couple of commendations for Test of Faith, I have some quotes here from Dr. Terry Morrison at InterVarsity, saying, "Students, professors, and all of us bombarded by arguments that science and Christianity are incompatible need help to maintain and defend our faith. I have not seen anything as good as the Test of Faith materials in encouraging and equipping us for this." So the first part of his quote is actually the one I wanted to focus on here, as lovely as the second part is. It's very, very important that we're able to think about these questions in an informed way, because they are very important. They will come up as soon as we start discussing apologetics, as soon as we start talking to people about God. We can almost guarantee that these questions will come up in a lot of situations. And to be well informed on those is a very, very important thing. Another one here from Dan Cho at the Veritas Forum, saying, "The relationship between science and Christian faith is one of the most critical questions for the church, the academy, and the culture at large. Test of Faith provides a rare, extraordinary opportunity to explore this challenging issue with some of the world's leading scientists." So hopefully by this point, if I haven't bored you completely with things that you already know, I've convinced you that questions of science and faith are quite important, that they're important for Christians to consider, and that it's a good thing for us to be considering them. And I hopefully have started to convince you as well that Test of Faith is quite a good way of doing this. So what I'm going to do for the next few minutes after this, and please feel free to ask as many questions in this as you want to, is explore a little bit of what Test of Faith is, the type of resources we've produced, how it can be used. To do this, I'm going to play you the trailer, which I haven't played yet. If you haven't seen it yet, then this will tell you a little bit about Test of Faith, introduce some more of the ideas covered in it.
All of our mental lives, all of our emotional lives, all of our feelings, all of our highest thoughts are rooted in the biology of the brain.
There's a vast yawning gap between what you might have the neural processes that go on inside here with the simplest mental experience of seeing red or getting hungry. We just don't know how to bridge that gap. Is there something more to the human person than just our genes?
It is very, very easy to cross certain boundary lines. And once we're on the far side of them, we just have no idea what's going to happen. I think if a human term weren't to be born, he or she would be a spiritual being, because that's how God has made us.
Both science and Christianity are pursuits of truth, and truth should mesh with truth.
stories which go beyond science, because truth is more complex than just the scientific truth.
One has to have a worldview, one has to have a source of value, one has to have certain principles. Those don't come from science. Those just don't come from science.
My prayer when I'm dealing with these issues is that the Holy Spirit will give me the virtue of wisdom.
I think exploration is a divinely Christian activity.
I have reasons for my religious beliefs, just as I have reasons for my scientific beliefs.
We have experiences which are very, very important to us, but without belief in God, we cannot make sense of them.
I think we have to recognize that in science we don't know all the answers, and there are certainly a great many things we don't know that are outside the domain of science.
It's a non-starter to say that science replaces faith. Science will not replace faith. It can't.
There you go. Certainly a more flashy introduction to Test of Faith than I could give by myself. That's a bit of an example of the type of work involved in the DVD, as you've seen already from some of the other video clips. So I'm going to go through some of the resources that are involved in Test of Faith now to explore a little bit more about what it is. There are quite a few of them, but I'm going to try and make sense of them for you. So the first bit, just to say that Test of Faith is an introduction to science and Christianity from high-level practicing scientists with sincere Christian faith. You've seen a few of them there already. It's designed to be accessible, to be multi-level, and to be multi-purpose. This isn't designed for academics necessarily. It's designed for people who want to explore this at whatever level they're at, of different ages, educational backgrounds, different knowledge of science, and different knowledge of the Christian faith. This has been used in many cases to use in groups, including Christians and non-Christians, so it's not exclusively for the church, but it's also been used in many, many contexts within the church to help Christians to explore this for their own knowledge, their own understanding, and also to equip them for conversations with those who don't yet know Jesus. So it's made up of several different parts. As I said, we have the film around which all of these are centered. We have a book that accompanies those. I'll go into some more detail on each of these in just a minute. We have some small group study guides for different groups, different ages. We have a church service, and then we have online resources on top of that. So a bit more detail on each of these. The film, and I could wave all of these at you. I've got them all out on the table here, so please do come have a look at these afterwards. The film is on a DVD. It's three 30-minute documentary series, and they cover distinct different areas. So the first chapter looks at an introduction to science and faith and astronomy, some cosmology. The second chapter looks at creation and the environment. And the third chapter looks at neurology and ethics, and that's the one that starts to look at things like cloning, as you saw in the trailer just then. There's also 80 minutes of bonus interviews, some of the sort of talking head type interviews that you saw that are included on the DVD. And it won several awards when it was launched in 2009, lots of media awards, some new Christian media awards. It did very well. It's very well produced. It's been highly acclaimed. As you can see from the bottom here, the audio on the DVD as standard is available in English, Arabic and Farsi with subtitles in a number of different languages. There are some more international versions of various parts of the Test of Faith materials, which we'll get onto in just a minute. So the book that goes alongside this is the testimonies, the personal stories of some of the scientists involved. It tells the story of how they became Christians, how they became scientists, and for them personally, how those two things go together. This, again, has been very highly acclaimed. It's helped people to get to know the scientists a bit more, and there's been a lot of feedback on this, saying, actually, it was really helpful and really interesting to get to know them a bit more. Many people pass this book on to friends who weren't Christians to say, look, here are some people who believe in God and believe in science, and see how they fit them together. It's an easy read, it's not full of jargon, it's not academic, and it includes contributions from these people who you've seen already in the videos, people like Francis Collins, Alistair McGrath, John Polkinghorne, various others.
No idioms?
No idioms, none at all. again, this book has been translated into various different languages, and some details on that a bit later. I mentioned the small group study guides. Now, these are produced for different types of small group study for different ages. The first is the leader's guide and study guide, which are produced for adult study groups, small groups in churches, also very usable by students at a sort of undergraduate level and above. They're a 3 to 6 week course. It's very adaptable. They're designed in chapters around the DVD. And so it's very, very adaptable to your particular situation. They can be easily broken up into smaller chunks or stretched over longer time periods, however you feel you want to cover them. It's very flexible and accessible. There are different difficulty levels involved that are listed in the chapters. So it will say, well, this is your introduction, and if you want to go further on, you can add this bit. And if there are people interested in the neurology here, you can add this bit. It gives you suggested reading. It gives you suggested places to go to look for more information on certain topics, should they be of particular interest to your group. They're designed to promote open discussion and a range of views, so it doesn't just present one view, it will present lots of different views, allowing people to be informed, to make up their minds, and again, suggest different areas and places to go to look for more. Another way in which the small group study guide is used is in school and homeschool material. So this is an area that is vital for young people to be thinking about. As I've told you a little bit already, and I'm sure you've picked up from my work and the work that I do, this is something that is really very important to present to young people in a way that allows them to ask questions about it. It's not something they often get the opportunity to do in schools, certainly in the UK and in many other countries as well, I'm aware. So this kind of material is designed to help them think through these questions and also to facilitate teachers, because teachers often don't feel equipped even if they wanted to cover this type of material. You may have science teachers who don't feel they know enough about religion, or religious studies teachers who don't feel they know enough about the science. This is designed to give them background information to help them equip themselves to cover this kind of course. The school lesson plans and resources are aimed at UK ages 14 to 18. They are based around the UK school curriculum, but very adaptable and flexible to other types of curriculum, other people of those ages exploring this. There's a special edition DVD which is available with the school's resources. The homeschool course was designed with the American market in mind, a flexible 3 to 8 week homeschool course, which again provides background information, provides photocopiable worksheets, same as the school's resources, lots and lots of resources, everything you could want to do a lesson on this. Again, in the spirit of presenting this to young people, we have youth group resources. These were developed with Youth for Christ in the UK, but again applicable across a number of different nationalities. And we have flexible sessions for 11 to 14s and for 14 to 18s, separate sessions designed with those age groups in mind. Again, flexible, different lengths. You can split them out for as long a course or as short a course as you want. They include ideas for games, ideas for all kinds of different things for youth group sessions. I mentioned the church service. So we have a resource put together with Bible Society for an all-age church service. You saw one of the clips earlier. So this includes specially commissioned videos, PowerPoint, has liturgy, prayers, readings, sermon notes, all-age activities, even song ideas and all kinds of things to produce a service in your church, which is a very positive celebration of science, which is a way of saying this is science, this is exploring God's creation. Here's a really positive approach to it with some beautiful media, some beautiful songs, all kinds of things weaving in together to very gently, openly and positively introduce the topic of science and faith to an entire church congregation. And again, this, as with many of the other resources, are available online to download freely. So the international editions that I promised you, all of the resources are available in English for the US, the UK, Australia and New Zealand, and anywhere else where they speak enough English, which from the look of this conference seems to be pretty much everywhere in Europe. I'm standing here being the ashamed English person with no such grasp of other languages. We have the book and the DVD translated into Brazilian Portuguese. It looks like this. We have the DVD and the course material translated into Chinese. This is available on a memory stick, and it's freely available. There's no copyright on it, so if somebody gets hold of a copy and they just pass it around everybody they meet. It's a wonderful system. We're very pleased with it. We have the DVD and the course guides translated into Dutch. We have the DVD and course guides translated into French. And we have the book in Portuguese. There are a number of other possibilities. Obviously, there are many other languages these things could be translated into. We would love for that to happen. We work with people in the country in question in order to do that. So if there's a company, a group, an organization who would like to see these materials or some of them translated into another language and they get in touch with us, then we do everything we can to make that happen. So each of these has been produced in conjunction with another organisation. And they're all available to order from our website. There's also the book and the DVD in Spanish. The course is in production in Spanish, so it's not quite out yet, but it's coming soon. I mentioned our online resources. We have a website with all of the content, links and information on other useful and related resources. So everything is available through the website. The majority of it is free. The DVD, the book, and the course and leader's guide for study groups are available to buy through the website. We also have a YouTube channel with several clips from the DVD and lots and lots and lots of bonus material. There are hundreds, possibly thousands of videos on there on all kinds of different topics to do with science and religion. We get a lot of traffic on there. It's really quite popular. And they get a lot of traffic through social media as well. There are also international online resources for most of the countries that I've talked about. They have their own websites for this material. And the links to those are available through our website as well. The last thing really to say is that Test of Faith is part of a wider family. It doesn't sit on its own. As I said, it's produced from the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion, with whom I work. But it's part of a wider family, particularly within the work of Ruth Bansevich, who I mentioned earlier. She edited all of the Test of Faith resources and since then has moved on to other projects. This is her recently released book, God in the Lab, looking at how science enhances faith. Again, very popular level, a very easy read. I highly recommend it. Featuring any number of scientists looking at a really positive understanding of science in conjunction with faith and how that works on a practical level. It's also a part of her wider body of work called Science and Belief. And the home of that is this blog, scienceandbelief.org, which looks at a positive interaction between science and faith. She publishes a blog on here weekly, sometimes with guest writers, sometimes by herself. And as you can see from the tabs up there, Tests of Faith exists within this family. So we have Science and Belief, we have the blog, we have the work out of that, the God in the Lab book and some videos along with that, and the Test of Faith resources, all a part of this, as well as another project which she's just started working on, which is for now under wraps, but very exciting, I promise you. So it's part of a much wider family of work, all out for communication of science and belief, of Test of Faith, of all of these things, to try to help people understand science and faith in a way that's applicable, that's engaging, that gets a hold of them where they're at and helps them to think about it in a really positive way. Got a few more recommendations and things that I can leave up here for you to look at, just because there were so many to choose from. But I really want to thank you for your attention. Now is the official time for asking lots of questions if you'd like to. And please do have a look at the materials as well if you get beyond wanting to talk to me about them. Yeah?
Why is it so widely spread that science proves that Christianity is not true?
That is a very good question. Do I think there's a hidden agenda behind people's idea that science has disproved faith?
Perhaps.
Quite possibly, that's one way of looking at it. I think to discuss the reasons why a lot of the media seems to show that science has disproved faith, we could be here for ages. One of the reasons I think it's so prevalent in the media is that the media loves a story. It does very well in newspaper production and in all media production where you have a big story, a big contrast, a big clash. So something like science disproving faith in today's world does very well in the headlines, whereas by contrast, a story about something that says, well, actually science and faith get on quite well, doesn't make such a big splash. But that's only a tiny part of a much bigger story as to this apparent conflict between science and faith that's been going on for a very long time. Some scientists would say, as you say, that science has maybe disproved God or that Christianity can't be true because of science. I think you tend to find that less amongst people who are studying science than those who aren't necessarily looking at science. But I think what I would say as a very general answer to a huge question is, as I pointed out very early on, I think the idea that science has disproved faith is generally down to a misunderstanding either of science and what science does, or of faith and what faith is, or probably a misunderstanding of both of them. The famous example, of course, being the idea that faith, the Christian faith, is a blind faith or an acceptance of something in the face of evidence. And so that kind of idea of faith, which I think most of us would say Christianity is not, That Christianity is very much based on a rational understanding of things, as well as an acceptance of something that is maybe beyond what we can see physical evidence for in front of us. That it's not a case of blind faith. It's not a case of just flying in the face of the evidence. And as you see examples up here, there are many, many people who hold science and faith together, as well as those who say science doesn't work with faith. So it becomes very much an issue of our worldview and how we approach science within that. But there is a vast misunderstanding of science, of faith, and of their interrelation across our culture, which is why resources like this exist. Quite why it exists to the prevalence that it does, as I say, we could discuss for a long time. But hopefully we're trying to do something about that. Our work in schools sometimes uses test of faith materials. We don't always use the test of faith materials. So when I go into a school, I don't necessarily use the test of faith lesson plans. I will sometimes use video clips from it, but not exclusively. So when I go into a school, what I present will vary greatly depending on what the school has asked for, the context I'm going in. Sometimes I go into a science lesson and I'm teaching on a particular aspect of science and also talking about the philosophy of science, so the kind of questions it does and doesn't answer. Sometimes I'm going into a religious education lesson and covering topics so they will sometimes look at cloning and things. They will sometimes be looking at particular topics like cloning, ethical topics, so I may cover some of those and bring in some science and religion aspects to that. Yeah. In some curriculum, particularly for sort of 17, 18-year-olds in the UK, science and religion is a topic within the course for religion, philosophy and ethics, so I will sometimes go in and cover that. There are any number of ways that I'll go in. So in a Christian Union setting, I'd be much more likely to use some of this material that is more overtly Christian. But a lot of the test of faith materials and a lot of our other materials are very applicable in a setting that doesn't necessarily have a Christian backing, because they're introducing ideas of questioning science, questioning the world around us, thinking, well, what does science do? And what other types of questioning are there? So in many cases, that would be very usable in schools, whether they had a Christian foundation or not. So the test of faith resources have been used in schools with a Christian foundation. In the UK, we have many schools that officially have a Christian foundation, but don't necessarily have a lot of influence of that in their everyday teaching. But they will sometimes bring in those kind of materials. They have the freedom to do that. And so many of those will be government-supported, state schools, public schools, depending on how you talk about it. So there is huge variety, but they have been picked up in many, many schools, used well. We, a few years ago as well, when Test of Faith was first brought out, we ran a project called Test of Faith Live, which involved some musical artists who are Christians in the UK taking the material around to schools on a roadshow, and they would perform live science experiments, present some of the material, have a scientist speaking. There's a similar project called God and the Big Bang now in the UK, where we run day workshops for a school, and we will go in, we will have a scientist who's a Christian to give a keynote, a talk on some aspect of science and faith, their particular research. We have science demonstrations and workshops and all these kind of things. So many, many schools are very open to this kind of questioning, particularly when it's framed as interdisciplinary, as encouraging young people to think outside of the box, to bring different types of questioning together. We will sometimes get into schools through personal contacts. If some of us know teachers, or if we know of people who know teachers who have interest in this, we make contacts through that, sometimes through parents, sometimes students. Particularly for Christian Union settings, they're often run by students or organised by students, so students through churches and other contacts, or teachers through church contacts. We also have essentially cold called many schools. So we just send an email out. We have some official emails that we say, we're presenting this kind of opportunity to you. It's interdisciplinary. It will encourage your young people to think. It covers these curriculum points. Please get in touch if you'd like us to. And again, the Faraday Institute, not as a Christian organization, but as an academic research institute concerned with the interrelation of science and religion. So we're not going in as a Christian organisation, but they are aware that if I go in, I'm going in as a Christian talking about science and religion. And I will say, I'm talking about science and religion. I am a Christian from my perspective. I'm talking about things from a Christian perspective. So you're not saying this is absolutely true, but you're saying this is what I believe within this context. Please feel free to ask me questions about it. And there is freedom in UK schools to do that, which is a real blessing. Your question. Yeah, absolutely. So the question of miracles is one that's covered in the resources as well. So as well as covering different interpretations, different ideas are introduced. So young earth creationism is discussed, intelligent design is discussed, theistic evolution is discussed as ways of thinking about God's involvement with creation. On top of that, there is discussion of things like miracles, as you mentioned. So there is, as I say, there is discussion of miracles. Also in the written resources, it gives opportunity to question those further. So with input from scientists and theologians talking about miracles, what it might mean for God to intervene and to act outside of the natural laws which he's set up. And then that's discussed further within the written materials to say, what might it mean if this, that, or the other? How might we understand this as relating to miracles? How might we do that? So it does bring in those different ideas, yes.
One has to be careful in our time that people don't misrepresent, don't understand God to be like, almost equal to nature. So I was very happy when you said personal goddess, right at the very beginning.
In a lot of these situations, particularly in schools, I wouldn't cover things anything like this briefly. So one of the presentations I did a little while ago in a school which was a private school in the UK, so an independent school, very high-flying scholars class. So they were students from the age of 14 to 18, and they were on the scholars program, which meant they were very intelligent. They, you know, had all earned their places there, and they knew it. They were a wonderful group, and I was asked to go into this special scholars program to give a presentation looking at science and religion, particularly from a context of history. So in that case, we looked far more deeply into the wider picture of science and religion throughout history, right from far more detail of the ancient Greek through the Islamic world, the difference between what happened when a monotheistic idea of God came in compared to various other ideas, and how those either contradicted or fed into each other. And some of the insight from the young people there was incredible. So you often find that the questions that young people will ask will be the same questions as adults would ask, often more so. I often prefer the questions from young people, to be honest, because they ask all the questions that adults think they're too grown up to ask. Yes, Alex.
So I think it's excellent material and really very persuading, actually. And when you are invited to a school class, sometimes you speak about cloning, sometimes you speak about general science and faith. How do you prepare for that? Do you have so many books at home, or are ready-to-use lectures that have been constructed at the test of faith? Because you're a biologist, so
yes.
What do you know about Big Bang? So who's training you, or how do you go about that? Because in Germany, we would have different speakers for different topics, and you seem to cover all of the topics.
I could just tell you that I'm a genius and I know everything. That's not the case. In many cases, if we're going to cover a topic in a lot of detail, another speaker who is an expert in that area will go in. Where possible, we aim to have experts talking on their subject, particularly, as I mentioned, for day conferences, where we have opportunity for a talk on cosmology and a workshop on evolution and these kind of things, in which case I have a collection of fossils and things that I take in, and I do sessions on evolution and how that works, which is more my area of expertise, as you point out. But for some situations where you have an hour-long lesson and you're covering the general relationship between science and religion, with, say I have an hour-long lesson and I'm covering general relation of science and religion, the teacher has asked for some focus on cloning, on ethical discussions, which as a biologist I have some background in. I've covered some molecular biology and some genetics, and enough to teach at a level which provides enough information for a high school class or something. Not to say that it doesn't require learning to do that, but I, with my background, if I feel I have enough that I can gain with some extra reading and some research, I also have the benefit of an incredible blessing of working within the Faraday Institute with a lot of people who are very, very highly expert in many areas, and I have contact with a lot of people, so I can go and talk to a geneticist or a cosmologist about particular areas. And obviously, if I'm asked to speak on a topic that I don't feel I can speak on with authority or with enough, then I will say that and either send in somebody else or change the topic with the school. So I don't claim or pretend to be an expert on every area at all. But there is some freedom in the context in which I work often, in that presentations are shorter. They often focus to some degree on a general introduction to science and religion, about which I've done quite a lot of reading and research. And question and answer times, as with any subject, tend to wander around quite a lot, and there will be questions that I can answer on areas of expertise or on apologetics generally or my personal faith. There will sometimes be questions that I can't answer, to which I will either say, I can't answer that, that's outside my area of expertise, or I can't answer that, please go and read this book or this website article or something. So I think that always happens, yeah. The first thing to say is the materials, the test of faith materials, in as much as they provide lots of different ways of looking at this, if there is a viewpoint that comes through that is the general viewpoint of the materials as the general viewpoint of most of the scientists involved, it's not a support of non-overlapping magisteria. It's not to say science and faith don't have any interrelation with each other.
Yeah.
It's very much to put, as I said right at the start, to put science in a context of faith, to say that within a Christian worldview, science forms a very important and very beautiful part, a way of discovering God's world. So it's not negating or denying the fact that there are places in which science and religion interrelate. It's very much supporting that idea.
Yeah.
And then within that context, there are various aspects of some of the particular ways in which those interrelations may come up that are discussed. As we mentioned miracles earlier, some of the ideas relating to creation and how God might have been involved in that in different ways. So those types of ideas of the truth claims or the fact claims of Christianity, as you say, would form one of those areas in which it would be a sense of, well, practically speaking, in this particular example, how do science and faith interrelate?
Yeah.
If we look at the Christian faith and we see that it appears to make a truth claim here, how does that interact with faith? And at that point, you would have input from different scientists and theologians talking about it, perhaps giving different opinions, saying, well, to my mind, I would say here that we need to think differently about the science, or to my mind, we need to think differently about the faith, or what it's actually saying to us, or the genre this was written in, or however it might come across in that particular example. So it's not an avoidance of that, I don't think, but a way of presenting ways of looking at it. So it's not so much an abstract discussion of, oh, Christian faith says this, but we have people here who are Christians who are claiming their own personal Christian faith, particularly the book that gives their personal stories, where they talk about their conversion, their testimonies, you know. Francis Collins, who was a medical student, and he talks about his questioning and his atheism and the things that drew him to think about the Christian faith through his medical studies. For a number of the people involved, their studies of the natural world, their exploration of it, drew them to think about questions of, well, what does this mean for so many of these other questions I have about life? So it's very, very much deeper than an abstract kind of, oh, faith deals with that and science deals with that and we'll leave it there.
Yeah.
And I think the person involvement really engages that. So the first thing I would say to relate to both the picture with the boiling kettle, with the mechanism and meaning description, and also to the jigsaw. What I'm trying to say there, as I say, it's not underlining a non-overlapping magisteria view. It's saying there are different aspects to our questioning of the world. The difference is in saying that it's not a case that you have science over here dealing with all the fact and that's all you need to consider. Because in that case, if we took our example of the kettle, we could have our science and that would be enough on its own. We would know that. But what we're recognizing in the example is that actually there's more than that. And again, all of these pictures, these images, they're useful to a certain level and the analogies often break down. But I had scientific questions as one of the pieces of that, and religious questions as another, ethical questions as another. So what that's trying to demonstrate is that the type of questioning that we look at, so a specific type of scientific questioning for mechanism, the type of scientific questioning we would use in the everyday described mainstream scientific method, are a particular type of scientific questions. which don't approach questions like, is there a purpose to life? Is there a God? All those kind of things. And they don't approach questions like, what's right or wrong? They don't approach questions like, should we help children who are starving? They might tell us what we could do to help them, but the science doesn't tell us whether or not we should. It's a different type of knowledge and a different type of questioning. So that's what I'm saying initially with the different types of them. The reason it's a jigsaw is because they interlink with each other. And as I mentioned a little bit, when you start to look at one type of questioning, you find that it links in with another, that it is related to another type of questioning. And so that's what I say with the religious questioning as well. It's not that the two are distinct from each other and totally different, but then when we recognize the particular type of questioning we look at within science, we find that it links in with religious questioning to do with meaning and purpose. Now, the reason it's represented like that is because it's an introduction to exploring and explaining scientific type of questioning in relation to wider religious or faith ideas. But what we say within the test of faith, as I said at the beginning, is it's trying to place ideas of science within a context of faith. So for a Christian, we would say, and as I explained with my idea of God earlier, God is not just an explanation for a natural thing. He's also not just a God of the warm and fuzzy. But our understanding of God is much wider and much broader of that. So when we think about a Christian life and a Christian understanding of the world, and we're thinking about God as the ultimate creator, the ultimate author of everything, and science as one way of finding out some of his world, something about his creation. It's not to say that religion has nothing to do with that, but that those types of questioning exist within a context in our worldview that has to do with God. Yeah, so there is no argument here that God is not involved with the natural world today, or that he has not been involved with the natural world throughout history. The questions that we're covering are to do with what type of involvement God has and how we discuss that. So things to do with miracles, things to do with what is God's involvement in science, what is the involvement of religion in science. And I think the main question here is whether religion can or should function as an answer to some scientific questions in and of itself, or whether it provides a context within which we understand our answers to those scientific questions as being a part of our worldview that involves God. That kind of understanding of science is the one that fits into this picture, as far as I see. So we see science as a way of exploring the natural world, of trying to discover the natural explanations, the laws, the patterns around us. But the way in which that relates to God or sits within our context of Christianity is we believe in a God, we believe in a God who created the world. A particular understanding of that creation is not the foundational principle for my belief in God, and therefore what we discover about science, although it builds into my picture of who God is as creator, it builds into the picture of the glory of God reflected into creation, and I might find it fascinating and beautiful and wonderful, changes in that scientific perspective and the understanding of the world around us are not going to cause a problem to my faith. My understanding of God as creator, as I say, doesn't rest on a particular scientific understanding of the world around me. It rests entirely on my belief in who God is and the fact that he is the creator. Scientific humility is hugely important, and I think it's a part of the reason that the more you discuss these theories and the more you get into the detail, and when you talk to people working in whatever area, and you go out to them and go, oh, tell me all the facts about this. And they'll say, well, you know, the more we find out, the less we know. Really, it might be like this, it might not. And I think that approach within science is something that isn't often recognized in the world around us. And that's part of what we try to get across. The one thing I'd say to finish this up is that as Christians looking to be involved in science, then we have far more to consider in our attitude and the way that we do science than any kind of triumphalism in a certain theory. You know, our priority in studying science and in talking about it must be to demonstrate love and grace and to be Christ-like, to demonstrate humility, as well as looking to celebrate and discover God's creation. And a Christian worldview says a lot more than creation is beautiful. It says, yes, creation is beautiful, but it also says that we live in a world that isn't perfect at the moment. For whatever reasoning we discuss for that, there are things about the world that are not perfect, that are currently not beautiful in every way, and we accept that as a part of recognizing the world around us and also recognizing our Christian faith and what that says. And there are reasons given for that in Scripture, but beyond that, there's a hope given. So we can, you know, I would and could discuss different aspects of the suffering question, the human responsibility for a lot of that. As we mentioned earlier, where we talk about natural events or natural happenings, natural disasters, and we see the huge numbers of human casualties in the tsunami, for example, or in earthquakes. And I think for a lot of that, humans have to take responsibility because we don't cater as well for those in the developing world as we could do. We could provide far more earthquake-proof shelters. We could do a lot more to look after the environment and help provide help where we can. I mean, the distinction in the number of deaths in the developed world and the developing world after an earthquake of the same magnitude is staggering. So there's a great degree to which I can say, well, actually, that's one of the reasons why we need to take seriously our call to stewardship, to looking after creation. But also there are many, many other things that we wouldn't attribute to human causes, certainly not to individual human sin, cancers, you know, all that kind of way of looking at life. And you could say, well, there's a lot in this world that isn't perfect. It is a very big question, and we always come down to it. And I think it is one of the most difficult questions and most important questions for us to consider. And it's a question on which I think we have to essentially, to summarize, say, well, the world is not perfect. And there is no claim in Christianity or in the scriptures or in our understanding of a relationship with God that everything will be perfect, that everything will be perfect for us when we become a Christian, that we won't suffer at all. We don't necessarily have a perfect answer as to why that is. But what we do have, as I mentioned earlier, is a hope. The scriptures focus on this hope and say the world isn't perfect. Stuff happens that is not nice. Stuff happens that is not perfect. And in schools, it's often very powerful. Sometimes when you talk about the suffering question, you can talk about it in an abstract sense. And sometimes you get the sense that people are asking it because they're talking about a deep hurt. And in such situations, I might share things like the fact that my mum died just over a year ago from cancer. And I've walked through difficulty and I've seen this. And there's nowhere in Christianity or in my understanding of a Christian faith that says everything's going to be perfect. But there is a hope that goes far beyond that. There is a deep sense of peace and joy, which I know from the scripture and I know personally having walked through that. That this comes into these other types of questioning that we talk about. That yes, there's scientific understanding that's relevant even to this particular story, you know, to cancer, to finding out how to cure it. It's a part of our stewardship of the world. But things still happen that aren't ideal and aren't perfect. But our understanding of Christianity doesn't rely on them having to be perfect, on there being no suffering in the world. Our understanding of Christianity relies on a personal relationship with Jesus, who promises us a hope in the future and a deep joy and peace and relational understanding in the meantime, which I can personally attest to.